So welcome, episode 103, usual formation. My name is Russell. Over the mountain in Caerphilly is Gareth. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm bad. I'm not too bad. Usually do this at the start. We're now doing it at the end for reasons that will become apparent later on. It's quite a postmodern podcast, this one, actually. And over several mountains in Innsbruck is Leon. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm all right. It reminds me of sort of Dutch total football of the 70s. You know, we're not quite sure what we're doing, but you know, it's all coming together nicely.
Absolutely, it's a time bending and paradigm bending, universe bending podcast this time.
We're bamboozled our opponents.
yeah.
Bamboozled ourselves.
Total podcasting.
Spoiler alert: the podcast is even better than I imagined it was going to be the first time I recorded this introduction.
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember how we led into the earlier bit. So what did I say? It's something around games have come thick and far. So actually, I've put my Christmas decorations up today with the kids, and but Christmas came early with all of those games in such a short space of time. 8 games in a couple of months. Does that work? That's not a good leading, is it?
I don't know. Have we lost the whole bit about your son scoring the pop-up goals?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Bet on him playing for Wales and Harry Wilson and all that.
That's right, yes. Yeah, you just a fiver. I could probably barely stretch that at the minute. But yeah, so I'll stick a couple of quid on him to play for Wales because he scored 2 in his first ever match.
At what point did you start recording?
It was after that. It was very quickly after that. It was soon after that. So yeah, that's okay. And yes, he scored a top corner. That's right. He blasted one into the top corner. If those pop-up semicircular half-moon goals have corners, which they don't, he made it lift off the ground as he scored it. So a net lifter, is that such a term?
There's
a net buster.
It is now.
There we go, we've just coined a new term, a net lifter. Right, I'll try and knit it together somehow, don't worry.
I wouldn't want to fall below our normally incredible professional standards.
Yeah, exactly.
The last couple of performances, I think, were a bit of an improvement again. I still stand by the idea that we've not played anyone of any great shakes, or certainly not beaten anyone who are up to much. At least we now know that the next time we are going to be tested at that level, you know. Or we'd like to have a big year of it now between qualifiers, Euros, and then eventually moving into a new Nations League tournament in 2022.
I'm excited about the next Nations League, you know, getting promoted. Group A up there with the big boys. It's going to be certainly a big step up from where we've been. But I feel like perhaps after a few more months and a few more games and some more experience for more of our younger players, we'll be ready to give it a good go. And it'll be exciting, hopefully, with fans back in stadiums to welcome some big teams to Cardiff. And yeah, like I say, it's always good to finish on a high. It was definitely the best performance against Finland. Certainly that they were down to 10 men for vast majority of the game helped. But something I wanted to bring up actually is that when you read newspaper reports of the game, they'll often say, Wales beat 10-man Finland as if Finland started the game with 10 men. They didn't. No, nobody starts a game with 10 men. Because we put pressure on them and he brought someone down, which was a clear goal-scoring opportunity and deserved to get sent off for that. So it was our kind of positive play, which resulted in the opponent getting sent off, which helped us big time. I mean, but it was a positive thing that we got the player sent off. He was quite right that he walked so early. Gaz, in the last podcast we did previewing these games, said he'd like to see the likes of Harry Wilson, David Brooks, Dan James step up, score a few more goals, and they did. So we can't really complain. It was a good campaign, all in all. Only conceding one goal in that final game as well.
Yeah, I think that's it's a good point Leon makes, actually, about playing the sort of tactical game to suit the 10 men. You know, he's right that we created that, and it's important that we kind of recognise that those players who we started with, who we'd hope to see a lot more from, the likes of Wilson and James, it was them pressing really early from the start that created a chance even before he got sent off. Even though we'd kind of gone with that more fluid front three and a false nine in the game before, and it hadn't really worked, and we'd had to bring on Kiefer Moore for the last half an hour, he still sort of stuck by that system, thinking it would work well against Finland, and it did, and it especially worked well after they lost the player. But then we kind of made the tactical shift to take Lawrence off at halftime, and you know, it's often not easy to sort of play a team that's lost a man. They often make it difficult for you, and I think the way we changed and adapted through the game and across the two games actually to sort of suit what we needed to do to get the wins was pretty impressive, you know, especially when you haven't got your manager there.
Well, yeah, and we'll come on to that in a bit. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you about the sending off, Leon. I think it reminded me of the one that Israel had when we played him out there, where, you know, a defender's just basically buckled under the pressure and has committed a foul and had no... You could see he had no complaints. He knew he was going. I suppose for them, it's a shame it was so early on, but it was great that we started with that intent and really kind of threatened them. Because I often find myself saying this, whoever I'm watching the games with, is that, you know, we've got such quick players that I wouldn't mind just seeing them run at players a bit more often, be a bit more direct and try and draw those fouls. And we did it, you know, really early on, and pretty much it was the first time we ran at them, I think, from memory, and as I say, they sort of buckled, and yeah, it was an interesting, I suppose it was harsh on Jamie Lawrence, but it was a substitution that worked, and it just cranked up the pressure, and that's what the best teams do. They see a weakness and they go for it in all sports, team sports, individual sports. That's what marks out good, great teams. And I'm not saying we're a great team, but I mean it's what a team would do to us if we were in the same situation. Yeah.
And back on that issue of sort of bringing it back, we learned our lessons a little bit from the Ireland game as well. You know, in the very first few minutes of the Finland game, we were getting the wing-backs pushed on a lot better, which was allowing us to sort of push those front three forward and play a sort of more high-pressing game. And then when they got the sending off, it just gave anyone trying to play wide that little bit more time on the ball. You know, we benefited a few times from Norrington Davis or Dan James later on having a little bit more time on the ball. So it made sense to make it a little bit more 4-4-2 when they're down to 10 men, or 4-5-1, or however you want to sort of describe it. So yeah, I think the way we sort of played across the two games and sort of selected personnel and sort of tactical changes to fit, you know, was really good.
Yeah, he looked like he was finding his mojo again, wasn't it, Dan James?
I was delighted to see him score. Really, really look good. And then what a fantastic piece of play again for Kiefer Moore. It must be at least the second time that they've combined with Dan James crossing from the left for Moore to head in. And that was fantastic to see. Just him running at people again. And then, you went back to United and scored for them, didn't he, for the first time in quite a while. So that was nice to see. I don't know if he played today, but a confident Dan James is a very effective player at international level. He showed that. It's a fantastic goal.
Yeah, I dug out the stats as well. I stuck it out on Twitter the other day of all those eight games. Nobody played in all of them, but there were four players that played in seven of those eight. And Dan James was one of them. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, that was more than what I felt and what I sort of recalled him in playing in. Yeah, Ethan Ampadu was the only person that started, you know, seven of those eight games, which just goes to show how crucial component he is in the team. I'll put you on the spot a little bit. Do you know who else played in seven games? There was only three, like I said, Ethan Ampadu, Daniel James and one other.
Morrell?
Yeah, Joe Morrell. Oh, I can't do my maths. Rubbish. Kiefer Moore. Yes, Kiefer Moore also played in seven. Sorry. But his was five starts, two subs. So yeah, they were the four. Sorry, I thought Morrell had a good autumn, and I think he's going to feel a bit unfortunate when Joe Allen and Aaron Ramsey are back. let's say when, and not if, because you know Ethan Ampadu is probably going to stay in the middle unless he's pushed back. But we've talked about Morrell before, and again, I just thought he was excellent in that Finland game. Just kept it kind of ticking, kept the tempo ticking over. Very rarely gave the ball away. And you know, for all what we're saying about, you know, Dan James and Kiefer Moore, and Kiefer Moore's been in the goals with Cardiff as well. Just metronomic, I thought, in the middle. I thought it was a great performance against Finland and a great autumn for him.
You can see him as still very much a young, improving international footballer. You know, I think, again, across the two games, a more average performance against Ireland, and certainly with a poor moment of judgment, which he was lucky to escape a red card for when he kicks out in the Ireland game. To then come into the next game a few days later and put in such a really good performance. You know, he was far more sort of influential on the game in the centre of the park than Ampadu was in that game. And you also just back to James a little bit, how significant those two games probably are for him. We talked a little bit, Leon's mentioned it already, about the need for those sort of, I guess, second tier players, if you think of Bale and Ramsey as our top tier players to show up as, and Wilson scored and Brooks scored a goal. But it was Dan James across the two games, coming off a sort of wretched time at Man United, who, without him, got a question whether we score against Ireland, because it's a lovely little ball he puts up, which, without that to start with, you know, I don't know if the goal would have come in that Ireland game. And then the sort of goal, not quite out of nothing, but that few players are going to score in that situation straight after half time, was really, really important. You know, we saw later on in the game a 15 minutes where we looked like we were starting to bottle it. And if we hadn't had a 2-0 lead at that point, if we were still sort of 1-0 up, that's the sort of game in the past we've thrown away and got a stupid 1-1 draw out of. So, and then of course he puts up that beautiful sort of left-footed cross for Moore at the end. So to be able to look back on two games and say, effectively, I was the difference between draws and wins, you know, by me's out at Man United, is really significant. And I hope he can really kick on from that, because at his best, he's a real, real player. You know, I think that the criticism he's had is about, you know, decision-making. Does he always get that final ball in? Well, you know, he shows what his final ball looks like when he's feeling really confident in those two games. You know, I thought he was absolutely superb.
Yes, no, I think that's more than fair. Joe Morel, he's on 12 caps now, and they feel like they've been accrued quite quickly. You know, Ethan Ampadu is now on 20 caps, which again is sort of, you know, remarkable to have hit that tally so young. So the fact that these games are coming, you know, have come thick and fast. You know, they are gaining that experience, which, you know, if you think back to, you know, obviously we covered this with the Toshak years, we were having friendlies against the likes of Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and Montenegro because, you know, many of our players weren't playing for their clubs, and so we were just going to need as many games as possible. But we don't feel like we're forcing it at the minute. I mean, the way it's panned out this calendar year, obviously, you know, is a bit strange. But there's potentially, you know, quite a few caps going into that squad now, going into the Euros next year. But then obviously the campaign that starts will start a bit before it, the next World Cup campaign. So I think it's been a good exercise. People talked about, you know, pointless friendlies, and, you know, arguably maybe the England one was unnecessary. But I mean, we had to play it by all accounts. I think it's been a good autumn for us. It's a shame that one defeat is that sort of one blot. But the squad does feel deeper than it did at the start of it, for sure.
Yeah, the England game was the England game, and it was kind of, you know, it was different. We didn't have anything like a first choice team. You know, they're always going to be strong, and it didn't feel, actually, looking back, and we talked about last time, that actually it was of any great consequence given where we were trying to take things in the Nations League. And looking back, that's even more clear now than it was then. Although talking about pointless friendlies, if we thought the England game was pointless, we hadn't seen anything until we got to the USA game, which none of us have even thought to mention as yet. Looking back, that was a really pointless fixture. Other than, we can look back at this sort of window as having to increase to 9 caps. Yeah. So that sort of that concern about whether or not he was going to get to 100 is looking slightly less nerve-wracking now. But I think if we focus in on the sort of competitive games, I think what are we now? Something like 11 straight competitive games, I think. Is that right? Isn't that our best sort of ever record of that? So, you know, we go into the qualifiers in a really strong position and hopefully full of confidence.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's also our best run. Between the goal we conceded against, was it Croatia at home, and the goal against Finland, 700 plus minutes, is the longest run of minutes without conceding a goal in competitive games as well. So
we're 12 hours. the next stat we'll be able to know is how many hours since Wayne Hennessy conceded a goal. if and when he comes back. He'll be clinging to that, I dare say. Although I thought, given it's something we talked about and we're quite worried about, I thought Danny Ward maybe not tested a huge amount during the three games, but didn't really put a foot wrong. And it was quite reassuring, given all the concerns we've had over his lack of first-team club football, that he was able to come in, and even at times when maybe defenders were making mistakes and still looking a bit uncertain, you know, he was a good last line to have there.
Yeah, he did okay, didn't he? I mean, it was his long that led to the red card, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Apparently, he's a decent player in his own right, outfield player. It was good vision on his part just to give it a hoof downfield. But you've still got to be accurate with it, and led to the card. So,
and there's a judgment in that as well. In the moment, sort of covering defenders have pushed a bit far up the pitch from the attack, and you know you've got to make that decision quickly, and you've got to be accurate with it. So that was really, really impressive.
Other thing with that defensive clean sheet stat is that actually over the course of those games, partly through choice but partly through necessity with some niggling injuries to players, there's actually been quite a lot of changes in that defensive lineup as well. So it's not as if it's I think back to when England had players like Campbell and Rio, extremely experienced players, top defenders as well, or your Costa Curtis. This isn't this old experienced gnarly central defensive pairing and experienced fullbacks, notwithstanding Chris Gunter's caps. There's been quite a rotation of the selections as well in that time. I think that's kind of nice to see as well.
You're getting close to actually admitting that we do perhaps have some strength in depth. Yes,
I think we're getting there. I think for me, the next 3 or 4 months is key. So, our players are going to be regularly playing league football, for their club. Whether that's at championship level is fine for me. I think strength in depth for me, and there's different definitions knocking around, is when there's a lot of caps under the belts as well, and there's a lot of league appearances under the belt, and so I think it's getting there. I think I've always been confident it was getting there, but I'd say we're still a little bit short of it, but I think we are getting there.
It's interesting is looking at Cardiff winning again today. And a lot of praise for Mark Harris, who was on loan at Wrexham last season for a bit. And since he's come into the team, Cardiff, they've won every game, haven't they? And he scored the other week. And it's just to see sort of someone appear almost from nowhere. I know he was playing for the under-21s and he scored against Germany, but... he's not someone who's sort of on the radar in terms of a senior call-up, but if he keeps playing well for Cardiff, and he's, by all accounts, he's linking up really well with Kiefer Moore, then there's someone else, another young player to bring in and sort of have a look at for Wales as well. So that's really promising.
Yeah, it's exciting that we've still got those players potentially coming through, and might add to that people like Brennan Johnson who played in the USA game, and particularly at Cardiff, there was no sort of sense that Harris was even on the radar for sort of getting in the first team to the extent he has in the last few games. So that's been really exciting to see as well. But I guess what we also need to see, and I in particular have thrown around some of these names a lot when kind of sharing those concerns about strength in depth and club football. But a few years ago, we might have looked to George Williams and Emir Hughes and these sort of players and saying, there's our strength in depth, because those players are going to really kick on and become good club football players. And it didn't quite happen for them and one or two others. So we are in a position where those players now who've put themselves in a position where they've shown what they can do at international level, albeit not quite at the top level of international football, we need Joe Morrell to not be another sort of could have been story in 2 years' time, and same with some of those other players. That's what will give us strength in depth, that that these players carve out really successful, at least championship and hopefully sort of Premier League careers for themselves, because I always have a sort of nagging doubt when I look at players like Morel, Lockyer, even Johnny Williams, I guess, to an extent, although I don't think we can really question now what he's done in his Wales career, in the way that they're in and out of club sides, or sometimes it's injury, isn't it, and they can't stay fit for any length of time. You know, that will always be a concern, and our strength in depth is never going to be that assured until we know we've got a really good pool of players, an established pool of players to draw on, you know, perhaps over a longer period of time, particularly given the relative youth in our squad compared to where we were in 2016.
That's what I'm getting at. It's that kicking on. It's not what they do in a Wales shirt. It's what they're doing week in, week out for their club. For me, is a bit more of a marker for whether that is strength and it is depth. I think what we have got, and I think this is what people tend to conflate with strength and depth, because it's a kind of footballing kind of term, if you like, a bit of a cliche term, if you like, is we have a much bigger pool of players to choose from. And that is unquestionable. Gone. There's players now you're kind of going, oh, he isn't lucky not to be in the squad. Christian Doigen comes to mind. You know, the players who aren't...
Will Volks,
yeah, who aren't getting into the squad. And you're thinking, well, hang on a minute, these have got, you know, a handful of caps under their belt and may even be playing regularly and still can't get in. You know, James Lawrence hasn't made a squad or two as well. So, you know, we are getting there. It's in the right trajectory. I think there's a danger that we conflate having lots of players to choose from with depth. And it does give us a strength, because it means, okay, if a player is injured, you bring in someone in of a, you know, a similar level, a similar level of experience. You're not just picking, you know, a journeyman, or you're chucking in a 17-year-old.
I think those two sort of trajectories, if you like, of strength and depth, perhaps moved a little bit closer, maybe even only in the last couple of games. I think we can probably now start to look at Wilson and Dan James and Brooks. And I know these were established players already, but I feel like now we've got a strong pool of attacking players in a way that we didn't even have, you know, back in the last Euros. You know, where we were losing attacking players then, things really were looking difficult. You know, we were arguing about, is it Tom Lawrence? Is it Tom Bradshaw? Is it George Williams who are going to be the sort of attacking threat for us? Well, I think now we're looking at Bale and Ramsey and Moore and Brooks and Wilson and James and a whole host of players like that who are now proven that they can do things at international level. We've moved past the sort of, or at least a lot past the Ben Woodburn, he's going to be amazing, and lo and behold, he sort of drops off it. Yeah, being another positive outcome of this Nations League campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. An example like Morgan Fox, who is Stoke City's regular left back. They're currently fifth in the Championship. He's a player with a decent career, over 100 appearances for 100-ish Sheffield Wednesday before moving to Stoke earlier this year. He's never even been called up for a squad for us. I mean, that would have been sort of unthinkable in the not too distant past, that someone with that kind of career wouldn't be anywhere near the Wales manager. You know, he played for the under-21s. His last appearance was 2014. He's 27 now, so he's not old. But due to having Conor Robertson, Nico Williams, Reece Norrington-Davis now as well, these options of players at fullback, for me, that's a nation of squad depth, or a bigger pool, call it what you will.
Definitely a bigger pool.
He's a really good example, Fox, isn't he? Because that kind of player, 10 years ago, if he was 10 years sort of older, he'd probably have ended his footballing career with, 13, 14 Wales caps, wouldn't he? You know, he'd be a sort of Adam Matthews style, player who's in and out of the squad. Whereas it does seem much more likely now that there's another young player in almost any position coming off the rank, and Norrington Davis in that particular position is a really good example of that. But he's also an example of what we were talking about a minute ago, that we don't want a player like that who's now proven in a couple of international games that they can look pretty tidy and they can put in some good crosses. We don't want that to be him flattering to deceive and maybe being no further on in a couple of years' time. It does look like he's of the collective we've got at Luton Town. He does seem to be the one who's sort of playing week in, week out, and, you know, is one of their better players. So he does look like he's really promising. In the game in particular, was really impressive. Some
left-backs is still Neil Taylor knocking around, of course. So, yeah.
I mean, to go back to Joe Morel, it's interesting that, I mean, I still look earlier and he was left on the bench again for Luton today when they lost to the Swans. He just doesn't seem to be able to make a breakthrough at club level. It's very strange considering how good he's been so far for Wales in his 12 caps. I don't know what's going on there.
It's really strange with him, isn't it? Because you kind of get it when it's a young, well, Harry Wilson back in the day or Ben Woodburn or one of these players going on loan to League One, and maybe they're a bit slight and a bit naive or whatever to deal with that competitive first team football in the lower leagues. But Joe Morel, he's combative, but he's shown that he's tidy, he's a good ball player. It does seem hard to believe that at Bristol City or that Luton, he wouldn't just naturally fit into that side as an obvious first choice player, given the way we've seen him play for Wales. I mean, I wonder if maybe there are some of these players who, given that I guess we're fortunate to maybe for the last few years to have, you know, four or five really good quality players, you know, it allows players who perhaps are a little bit more limited to look that bit better, to play above themselves because, you know, they're receiving and giving the ball to you know, players who they wouldn't normally get to play with. You know, so I guess that's another factor in whether they can sustain that as a longer term international career thing. You know, is it something that they can keep coming back and doing because they put themselves in a really strong position in club football and they're improving as a club player? Because I think players stagnate if they don't do that, and that has a bearing then on how they perform at international level.
And when Joe Allen comes back, you know, he slots straight back into the side. So, you know, Morel sadly probably ends up bench warming for the Wales team as well. But you know, that's competition, and that's good. I mean, I suppose there was a feeling on occasions under Coleman that it was harder to play yourself out of the team than to play yourself into it. I think he belatedly started to freshen that squad after the Euros towards the end. And, you know, it was clear, obviously, when he was going that, you know, he started blooding the likes of, or he started giving caps at the very least to the likes of Brooks and Ampadu and so on. But that, you know, looking at it dispassionately, that is only a good thing. You know, Josh Sheehan came on against the United States, of course. So, you know, there's another small, compact, tidy midfielder, and Newport fans are amazed that he's still there and relieved and pleased, but are convinced he's going to be playing at a higher level soon. You know, so there's another one you can throw into the mix in the middle. But any other talking points? Because there's one name I wouldn't mind mentioning. He hasn't had a huge number of mentions lately, and that's Gareth Bale. And I thought it was, you know, nice that he got two little assists. You know, I thought he did get him back there, get him back to it.
Yeah, I thought he did well over the two games. It was quite interesting that, and I wonder if it's anything to do with him now, so turning up at Spurs, he's playing a bit, but on the bench a bit. He's competing with other really, really good players for a place in that team. And I wonder if he'll find himself, you know, playing on the right a bit, playing on the left a bit, playing centrally sometimes perhaps, you know, if, say, Harry Kane were to get injured. And it felt a little bit like, well, maybe that's something he could do for us. You know, he turned up on the left for a while. I think it was in the Finland game. He didn't seem to be like being used as the sort of central point of the front three very much, which I guess is kind of what we would have expected to see in those team sheets. But we had this sort of false nine thing going on with Brooks in the first game, and then sort of Wilson played that role for a lot of the second game. So I wonder if part of what we were talking about earlier of your younger attacking players coming on is that it's not so much work your game tactically around Gareth Bale and what you want him to do, but you fit him into a role based on the other personnel that are fit and available for that game. And maybe he plays as a striker, maybe he plays on the left, maybe he plays on the right, or, you know, has a role in different formations. But that, you know, the fact that maybe we won't be relying on him so much might free him up to maybe come back to something like the quality he's had in the past, because it has been a while since we've really felt that he's contributed in the way we know he's capable of.
Yeah, and also, of course, because he's back at Spurs, I don't think I've heard any reference to him in golf. No. I mean, is this a coincidence? I mean, is he retired from the sport, or is it just no longer the talking point, or even just a convenient stick to beat him with? And, you know, no one's going on about, no one's criticising his proficiency in Spanish and all that. The whole soap opera just seems to have ended.
That's a really important point. Like, the soap opera of it is so key, because it's not them to Spurs to form this sort of three-game, say 90-minute game and be, you know, the old Gareth Bale. It looks like he's going to be managed carefully. I know he's probably still not up full fitness, but I wouldn't necessarily be expecting him to play week in, week out for Spurs. But it won't matter at Spurs in the way it mattered at Real Madrid, because the relationship with the rest of the squad and the coach and the whole setup there is different. He, I don't think, will be sort of kicking off or overly upset if he's left for the bench here in the game, because he knows it can only be a good thing for us. I think it's going to work out even better than we thought. I don't want to jinx anything too much, but it could work out even better than we thought, because he's likely to play a sensible amount of football to keep him fit but not risk too much injury. And if that's the way he is going into the Euros next summer, then, you know, who knows what kind of quality we could see from him again. And like I say, it's been a while since we've really felt that his contribution has been as good as we would want.
Put
it
you
to
on
be.
The spot a bit. Do you think there's one more campaign in him then?
At least, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think, well, he's, you know, the World Cup qualifying campaign is coming up now. There's no question that he's going to be involved in that. And he'll certainly want to be going to that World Cup in 2022, were we to get there. Another one after that, another Euros. Who knows? What would he be by Euro 24, 35? Could have a role in that squad and that team, probably. And that role would have to evolve again in the way, I guess, it's kind of evolving now. But, you know, he loves playing for Wales, so it wouldn't surprise me. The best thing would be if it didn't matter that much. It sounds, you know, awful to say, but I'd like us to use the Euros and the World Cup qualifiers and hopefully a World Cup to put ourselves in a position by the autumn of 2022 where Gareth Bale being there isn't the be-all and end-all for Wales' first team anymore.
Oh, that's a big call. Anne Robinson on Points of View is going to get lots of letters for this now. I'm playing devil's advocate. I mean, I'm convinced he wants a crack at a World Cup, I'm sure. But this whole thing around your managing games, managing game time, a narrative can form there around you can only basically play so many games, and therefore is that going to be, you know, a number of Wales games sacrificed? But, you know, he's not playing every game at the minute now anyway, I don't suppose, and hasn't for a while. So, yeah, it was nice that he was provider. I mean, you know, never. You almost don't want to even bring it up because it gives, you know, there's a danger. It gives, you know, credence to what was obviously a nonsense thing around us being just this, you know, this one man team around the last Euros. But it's nice that of all the players we're talking about played really, really well. We're talking about a lot of other names. He also supplies two assists. You know, one of which was, you know, was a lovely little through ball.
Yeah, it was.
I suppose as well, when he is playing more central, you know, he just got that. You know, it does matter. I'm sure this goes through the head of other opposing defenders, where they're thinking, oh, bloody hell, it's Gareth Bale. You know, two of us have got to get tight to him. Or he just instills that sense of alertness and panic because he's just in amongst them. And then he just plays that little ball through. And you have to have the players who are smart enough to be able to, you know, make the runs and see what he's maybe thinking is on. I mean, I think Wilson, you know, is that sort of player, clearly. But it was that sense that, you know, for all of the good performances, he's not scoring the winning goals. He's not dominating that game, but he's still important and still good enough and has that quality to be able to just still influence the game, but not in that kind of really head and shoulders sense. And I think that does bode well with what you're saying, Gaz, in terms of great if we can have him, but if he's not 100% fit, well, okay, maybe. Because remember, was it the, oh, I'm trying to think now, was it the Croatian-Hungary game where he clearly wasn't 100% fit and just was forcing things, was almost like trying too hard. And I just thought, I'm not sure you can command the place in this starting 11 at the minute, but you're Gareth Bale, so you've got to. It doesn't feel like that now, and that's, oh, what's that, 16 months?
It's interesting you've been out, because we I guess we were half joking around it at the time, but looking back, that was a real low point, actually, and a point at which you felt something needed to change with the whole Real Madrid thing, because it wasn't sustainable for the Wales team that Gareth Bale be turning up with that level of fitness and go into the team and be that ineffective. And having him seen him sort of, you know, affect the game a bit, little bit more in the Nations League campaign, especially the last couple of games. You know, it does make you reflect on those earlier games and think, do you know what, we can't really just be putting Gareth Bale in the team because he's Gareth Bale. We've got to put him in the team because he's still got a lot to contribute, which of course he has. But his kind of role within the team, you know, there will increasingly become a time where if he's not doing so well, it becomes presumably easier to leave him out for a Brooks or a Wilson or a James. And kind of on that, what did you think about both of those, starting both of those games without Kiefer Moore? You know, it was quite a brave call given the sort of difference that's made. And I don't imagine Paige made that decision completely independently of Giggs, but the failure of not having that sort of focal point in our attack, and then when Moore came in, the difference it made in the last campaign, to seem like we were maybe moving back to trying something that didn't involve kind of Moore up top was kind of interesting and would obviously have an impact on what Bale's role in the team is going forward.
Yeah, I thought it reminded me a bit of perhaps the qualifiers for the Euro 2016 tournament, when Coleman sort of changed the team around quite a bit. It felt like we had a real sort of horses for courses kind of situation, not just in terms of personnel, but in terms of the team system as well. I mean, five at the back became the thing, which, you know, there were songs about and all that kind of stuff. But people forget we didn't always play five at the back during that campaign. And sometimes it was Robson Kanu starting up front, most of the time Robson Kanu, and then sometimes it was Sam Vokes. Or in that first game of the Euros in Bordeaux, it was Gareth Bale and Johnny Williams were the most sort of forward players. So we didn't really start with a recognised striker. And perhaps with Kiefer Moore, who's a fantastic player, and we've given him a lot of praise, and deservedly so, perhaps he's not going to be the first name on the team sheet for every game, which I think is fair enough. There will be times when something else will be required. Doesn't mean he's not a brilliant player who's had a fantastic start to his international career.
Paige talked about having this plan B, and I kind of thought when I heard that, well, actually it's not really plan B. It's the new plan A that replaced the old plan A, which didn't work. But then we went into the game, it seemed to click. Wilson, James and Bale were sort of on the front foot. You know, they were making the right runs, and they were picking passes to each other, and they were receiving really good balls from Morel in particular. So it does make you kind of think, well, actually, if we can get that system to work as an option, you know, and obviously Moore will be an option in a lot of games, but if that can work in an option against perhaps better teams and against teams when they're not down to 10 men, that's really exciting, I guess, if you then stick.
Yeah, I thought you were going to go, as a teacher, I think you might have been talking about your plan A and then plan A star. Is that transferable to football parlance?
Well, I don't know, because I don't have any A stars at GCSE. So whenever pupils ask me, and they often do, what I got in my GCSEs, I always lie and say I did my GCSEs in the day before A stars were a thing. So I kind of resent A stars generally. You know, partly because I didn't get them, partly because they're just a way of discrediting what was once the old ultimate accolade. So I don't think I'd ever apply it to football.
Anything else to say about the autumn games? We did mention Gunter getting to 99 caps, didn't we? Yes.
Yeah. It's. I guess on that issue of Gunter, we were getting our heads just before recording a little bit around the sort of fixture schedule for 2021, and it's pretty heavy in terms of competitive games, isn't it? So they've had to reschedule the sort of World Cup qualifiers to be able to accommodate Euro 2021 in the middle of it. So you've got a triple competitive header in March, a triple competitive header in September, and then two headers in November, the Euros in the summer. And I guess within all of that, it's hard to see how any friendlies will be played. And therefore, if Gunter's 100th cap is going to come, it's going to have to come in one of those competitive games, which I guess, does that make it a little bit more less likely, a little bit more difficult for that to happen? I mean, I know he came on right at the end of the Finland game, But will there be more caution toward him that, given that every game is likely to have so much meaning in the next year?
Well, I sensed I knew where you were going with that, and I dug out his appearances record for us, appearance data. He's only started one... don't get me wrong, you can come on as a substitute, I get that. But he's only started one qualifier. One competitive game, let's say, in over 2 years. So he started the Hungary defeat last June 2019. And the next one before that was Nations League defeat in Denmark. So his starts tend to come in friendlies. We're not going to be playing many of those. So it's a question of whether, you know, we are going to be making substitutions in competitive games at right back. And I suppose, you know, that depends if he's sort of second choice right back still. I mean, Nico Williams looks like he's probably edged ahead his second choice ahead of, behind Connor Roberts. But I can also see Nico starting at right back as well. I mean, I think, you know, these starts he had this autumn were part of that whole kind of, you know, but blooding him as one, but also just rotating that squad as we've been doing. Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to get there, but it might be another two or three games.
It's going to be, I think it might be by the skin of his teeth. Mm. I think, you know, I can never remember now what the sort of rules are around the number of substitutes. Is it the whole rest of your squad? And does that change for different kinds of qualifiers and competitive games? But I can imagine a scenario, and I forgive me for saying this, I can imagine a scenario where, first of all, he doesn't make the Euro 2021 squad, because if Norrington Davis and Ben Davis and Nico Williams and Connor Roberts are all in there, it's hard to see a place for him. So then you'd have to look at, well, is he going to be on the bench maybe for one of the qualifiers in March or September? Well, maybe, but you know, if they're picking purely on, you know, on merit, again, it's kind of hard to see. I mean, so I guess it might come down to the level to which sentimentality plays a role in things, and you know, maybe he's on the bench because of a couple of injuries against, you know, the fifth or sixth seed team in our group, and comes on in that game. And you know, I don't like to sort of talk in those terms about the way in which he sort of stumbles over the line to Andrew Camps, and it won't, if he gets there, it won't matter. I know, you know, there is still that nervous. The idea of him being stranded on 99 caps is even worse than where we were a few months ago when we were looking at he was on 94, 95, and we're thinking, oh my God, he might not even get there.
And on that basis, yeah. I was sort of annoyed that he came on so late against Finland to get 99, because being stranded on 98 is better than being stranded on 99.
Yeah.
It seemed a bit of a...
He'll get there. He's 31, isn't he? I mean, he's not 37. He's 31. I'm sure there'll be some opportunity within the next 5 years or so that he'll still be a professional footballer to get him onto the pitch.
Yeah, surely.
You do get
a Ranger friendly, for fuck's sake. So like, the, you know, like yeah. The Ranger of Cap, you know, like, I mean.
So here's a question then. Do you think if Giggs had been there, does Gunter come on in that Finland game? Is that a sign that Robert Page has got that bit more sentimentality? He probably might remembers coming to the end of his career at the time Chris Gunter was getting started. Is there any overlap? I'm not sure. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. It does smack a little bit of sentimentality for him to be only the second substitute, I think, who was used in that game and be stuck on for the last minute or
and
two.
It was. So, yes, it was.
You know, maybe he's got a better chance. If Robert Page is around for a little bit longer.
Yeah, maybe we need to arrange like a centenary anniversary friendly against New Zealand, and he can bookend his caps in that way. Well, okay, let's talk about Page then, because you know, I was very much of the view, you know, we didn't touch on it at all, really, the whole issue with Ryan Giggs, and I think it's still obviously a delicate topic. I was of the view that, you know, whatever Page is doing with that squad by way of preparation, planning, the whole sort of timetable, the itinerary and everything else, what they wanted to get out of those games had already been set by that coaching team, because I think that's how this sort of works. So I've seen a few comments talking about how, you know, why would we appoint Page, because, you know, his record as the under-21 manager was Northampton manager wasn't very, very good. And there's a world apart between, you know, managing Northampton and managing on the international scene. You know, by that token, I mean, Coleman's record wasn't, you know, great coming into the Wales job, and, you know, and look what he did. So I thought there were some sort of lazy criticisms of him because he's part of that coaching setup, as I say, and I think, you know, what was wanting to be achieved with the last three games had already been set. That's all well and good, but during that 90 minutes, he's on his own, as it were. You know, he's got Stuyvesant and others around, but he's got to manage within that 90 minutes that in-game management that, you know, it was referred to. And, you know, we mentioned the tactical change in the formation changes he decided on against Finland to press home an advantage. And I thought that was quite an assertive step to take in terms of, you know, in terms of managing that in-game situation. And I thought that was quite encouraging because I suppose there's a danger that someone goes, look, you know, okay, let's not make an absolute bollocks, let's make a decent fist of it. And okay, I'll be a little bit cautious, I'll be a bit conservative, let's not do anything too radical, too adventurous and come unstuck. But he seemed to be a bit more assertive than that. So what do we think about Rob Page?
I didn't really think he put a foot wrong. Players didn't seem in the slightest bit distracted by the changes. It seemed smooth. It looked like just sort of carried on from where we were in the last round of, if the job does become available, then he's put himself in the window.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, I think. And they were two games that required, tactical in-game judgments to be made. You know, we were pretty poor against Ireland for an hour, and then the system shifted in-game to fit around that. And ultimately, that brought us the goal and the win against Ireland. I guess we'll want a clearer picture of how things stand going into the qualifying camp. Ultimately, the Euros in the first half of next year.
I think as well, the other thing to bear in mind with him is that he will know a lot of the younger players because of his time as under-21 manager. So, you know, players like Joe Roden, Reece Norrington-Davis will have played under him, as Dan James, another one, would have played under him as the under-21 manager. So he's familiar with the players, some of the players, for quite some time. And I think that whole pathway, that whole Welsh Way thing means that actually, you know, there is a bigger group of players. It's not this a huge sort of chasm between, you know, the senior squad and then who's in the 21s, who's in the 19s. There's a closer kind of culture and more contact, you know, between the age grades. So, you know, he's familiar with those players. And if a change does have to be made for whatever reason, and not wishing to prejudge things, I mean, Giggs has been rebuilt till 1st of February. What goes on next year, early next year? You want continuity going into a tournament, surely. You don't, you know, just throw it all up in the air and bring in somebody, even if they are an old hand who's been there, done it, and, you know, coached at tournaments and all the rest of it. You'd want a bit of continuity, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, like you say, we don't know. We wouldn't want to prejudge what's going to happen. But if, for whatever reason, things have to change in a more prolonged way, well, we don't want a big directional shift in the first half of next year. You know, and if Giggs is there, great. But if not, it needs to be from within the setup, if at all possible. And, you know, Page has shown in these two games at least that, you know, that's something that hopefully we can manage. And, you know, time will tell now what happens after that.
It's a football podcast, not a legal podcast. So the legal side of things, we just have to let run its course, and the FAW will have to make those decisions, not us, thankfully. Really, I agree with what Gaz said there, that we need a big shift, some sort of wild card candidate to come in if it transpires that Giggs really can't or shouldn't carry on at all, then promoting Paid from within the existing setup is probably the way to go.
And it was kind of reassuring that it's a big shift in level for Page to be working at and being in quite so much limelight for. But I thought he spoke really well in front of the media before and after games, you know, and that probably reflected on what Russ was talking about, his sort of familiarity with the squad and the setup. The fact that Page seems articulate and sort of able to communicate what he's doing and why was reassuring as well.
Of winning our group in the Nations League, this is where it gets complicated. We are in the running for a playoff position, which means that if we finish outside the top two of that World Cup group, we have a second bite in the playoffs for that.
Almost certainly, unless there was some kind of really weird scenario where the likes of, you know, other top teams didn't finish in the top two of their group, it seems very unlikely that we wouldn't have that backup. But it's not quite the sort of golden opportunity of the Euro playoffs, which were determined by the Nations League. It's all the second place teams out of the groups, plus, you know, the two best sort of Nations League group winners then chucked into draws for three pathways. And therefore, the playoffs for World Cup qualification are likely to be, you know, reasonably challenging. You know, if you assume that top seeds win groups, you know, in most cases, then you're probably talking about your Serbias and your Ukraines and your Swedens rather than your Italy's and Germany's. But still, to win two consecutive games, if we don't win our group, and it's likely that we're going to have a very strong nation seated above us in our group, then it's not going to be easy.
Have an A star for understanding it all. Talking of qualifying, the women did what they did did what they had to do against Belarus, put them to the sword. Really, really impressive performance. And for a moment, when the Faroes had gone ahead against Northern Ireland, it looked like there could be something happening and something on for the women. But it was a 5-1, I think, the Northern Irish finished. And so it reminded me of a bit of the men back in the 80s, in the sense that it's this paper thin margin that has meant that the head-to-head record between us and Northern Ireland is in their favour, because basically away goals. You know, of all the ways that the men managed to mess up qualification in the 80s and 90s, you know, the width of a crossbar and all the rest of it, and seconds away from what is it, 84, wasn't it, I think? Was it Yugoslavia against Bulgaria or something? And they scored like the 94th minute or something. Anyway, whatever. I'm not sure that even the men ever managed to not qualify because of an away goal.
The two are reminding me of, Russ, is the under-21s
in
2010.
Yes. Yes.
When we lost 1-0 in Italy, which meant we finished joint top of the group with Italy, same number of points. We had a better goal difference and more goals scored. But the head-to-head was 2-2. So they went through on the way goal that they scored in Swansea in the game that we won 2-1, and we should have really won it 3 or 4-1 because we dominated that game. Some folks hit the bar with a header. That was like similar wafer thing.
You're right. Margins, that would have been that was essentially an away goal. Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, maybe it's part of a bigger learning curve, but you know, they've done well. Jessica Fishlock has said she's committed to another campaign, and she's like 120 odd caps, which is a figure that the men can only dream of. So well done to them, and also commiserations. I thought as well, since we last spoke, I thought it nice to pay tribute to, I thought, well, for me, the greatest player I've ever seen, Diego Armando Maradona.
Yeah, when Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo scored his 100th international goal, we had a little tribute to him, and I said after Rich called him the greatest international the greatest footballer of all time, I think Rich said, undoubtedly the greatest footballer of all time, I said I think he's the greatest international footballer of all time, and I'll stand by that, because you look at the stats, they're mad, but I would put Maradona second behind him as the second greatest international footballer of all time, considering his teammates actually weren't up to much in 86. If you look at some of the highlights, Maradona set up so many chances for tap-ins, which his teammates skied. Although they did come to the fore in the final, which Maradona didn't score in, to be fair, although he did provide the assist for the important goal, if I remember correctly. But just a ridiculous footballer, a genius, and I mean, there's been so much said about him that I don't feel qualified to add a great deal more. But just someone I was in awe of watching the 86 World Cup as an 8-year-old, and sort of falling in love with football at about that time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to my English father the other day, and he sort of he asked, you know, where I stood, I guess, on a comparison between Pele and Maradona. And I guess his opinions of Maradona are probably weighted down by the hand of God and that. But you know, I said Maradona all the way. My father's not a guy who would sort of enjoy the sort of, not enjoy is the wrong word, but be sort of fascinated by the sort of the darkness and the, I guess today we'd call it soap opera that came with Maradona. But I mean, that the fact that here was a guy of these kind of extremes who could still then drag, you know, a pretty average Argentina team or a Napoli team to kind of amazing heights compared to, you know, Pelé, obviously a great legendary player, but who played in incredible Brazil teams. And I don't know, just doesn't, for me, carry that same kind of fascination. And I guess, you know, I'm just about old enough to remember, you know, Maradona being an incredible footballer and watching him live. And Russ, you and I went to watch that documentary, didn't we, a couple of years ago when it first came out, a chapter, and just what a story and what a, you know, what a player. Yeah, I think it's a sort of sad loss, and many memories, and many, as I discovered this week, YouTube wormholes you can go down if you want to contribute to
Yeah, him. Yeah. And the one where he's, I think it's like it's just some training drills, and it's a waterlogged pitch. And again, just the mastery of the ball, remarkable. And I, it's the same as you, Leon, formative age. I'd been brought up by 9.5 in 86 World Cup, and was just mesmerised by him. And that was, again, I think, and I have this theory that, you know, the best World Cup is always your first World Cup. And that's why 86 is still the best for me. But I think it is and was a good World Cup. You had some good teams there. You know, the Brazil-France game, I remember the quarters stood out. Yeah. You know, England eventually coming to life against Paraguay. Poland obviously resonated in the UK. You know, Denmark were a great side. So, you know, it was a good World Cup. And you know, Belgium did well. So it wasn't as if it was a dour World Cup or a poor quality World Cup, but he played well. You know, there were a lot of players, good teams. And he dragged that Argentina team to the final. And I think what's interesting is that Argentina, it's in, pretty sure it's in Jonathan Wilson's Inverting the Pyramid book, is which I've mentioned any number of times on this podcast over the years. But they talk about how, I can see, I want to say Bilardo. It wasn't Bilardo, it was the manager. Who was the Argentinian manager? I can't think of his name. Carlos Bilardo came after him. But basically, in the run-up to it, under all sorts of pressure, and you know, had no right to do as well as they did in that World Cup. And Maradona, when you touch on it, because the clip that was doing the rounds went viral, they're shanking everything wide and over the bar, and he created all these things, put them all on a plate for people. He was just a tour de force. And of course, he was the same then with Napoli in Serie A, which is why he's so worshipped there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think...
A couple of things to say, sorry, Russ, but like... Yeah, it was as if in the quarterfinal against England, he decided for the second goal, like, fuck this, I'm just gonna do it myself. I'm not gonna pass to you fuckers. Keep skying my assists, and so he did it all himself. And I think there's actually an interview he gave where he was looking across very briefly when he was on this run to see what teammates are available, and he decided, I think there's a better chance of a goal if I actually just carry on and try and do it all myself. And then about 10 years ago, when I first moved over to Innsbruck, I worked with a guy from Naples, and after a few days working with him, I just mentioned the name Diego Maradona just to see kind of what his reaction was. I'd never seen a sort of a smile kind of light up a face so quickly. He was just worshipped by Napoli fans. He still is, and every cafe in Naples has a picture of Maradona in the cafe drinking a coffee because he'd just be sort of dragged into every cafe to get a photo. He's and there are murals everywhere. He's just he took that Napoli team to another level, and it was the first time a team from the south of Italy had ever won Serie A, and he was the main man.
As you say, when you watch that documentary, guys, you begin to realise it's amazing he achieved what he did given the amount of pressure and focus. So the pressure he was under and the focus that was on him to be able to perform under that level of scrutiny takes some doing.
Oh, so much. I can't tell you how much I love that documentary and how good it is. And it kind of makes me think about it again when you talk about formative World Cups and the one you remember first as being the best. I don't really remember 86. I've subsequently watched a lot of it. But I remember 1990, that was my first World Cup. And of course, Maradona then is, you know, especially, you know, over here watching, you know, a very English coverage of that World Cup is, you know, he's a villain. He's, you know, his Argentina team actually was perhaps even worse than the one from 1986. It was a really incredibly boring final. And, you know, there wasn't too much to celebrate. And then you watch this documentary, and I don't think I'd kind of had a bit more of an idea as I was an adult, but I didn't really get the full extent of it till I watched that documentary. Just the baggage he was carrying as a player in Naples in Italy going into that Italian World Cup, and all the sort of hardship that and the sort of difficulty from you know, from the Italian people itself and the media that came with that, and it just adds to sort of the view of him I've got now. What a player, and what a sort of fascinating life and career.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was telling as well just popped into my head was how, so this argument around, oh, is it Messi? Is it Ronaldo's the greatest ever? Well, actually, if you ask an Argentinian in the street, the answer is neither of them. It's this guy. It's Diego, which I think is interesting. And there was a nice tribute for Messi when he scored. Well, as he always does, he took a shirt off, and there was an Argentina. There was a Maradona shirt underneath his Barca shirt. I saw the other day. It was quite touching. So yeah, but it feels like a little bit part of your youth has gone, and I did feel quite melancholy for a couple of days because of it. And I put something out on Twitter only about 2 weeks before, kind of going, "Oh, this whole let's just celebrate the fact that, you know, Messi and Ronaldo, two of the greats, are playing the game now in their prime, and we get to see it, of course, as well." This is the point. You know, Maradona was so much more exotic, and it was a big sea change, I think, between 86 and 90, certainly 86 and, say, 94. It did feel so much more exotic, 86, because it was Mexico, because it was a different time zone, it was so far away. And I think that does add to it a little bit more when you're at that young age. But there's things that he did in a game only people in that stadium saw, because it wasn't televised, it wasn't recorded, and it's not on the internet. So just think of what the legend could be if you did get the chance to see everything. And I think that just surprised my mind, really. Cool, should we leave it there?
If it's not inappropriate to go from a sort of 10-minute tribute to the late great Diego Maradona, we didn't, I don't think, at any point give a shout-out to Joe Roden, who captained Wales, albeit briefly, for the first time. I thought he was particularly incredible in the Ireland game. You know, I know the captain's armband sort of seemed to weigh a little bit heavy towards the end of the Finland game. But I thought in the last couple of weeks that he's done that and started a game for Spurs, you know, would fit in really nicely with what we were saying about the sort of the up and coming group of players we've got, and hopefully we are turning now that level of player into part of strength in depth. I thought he's doing a really good job of kicking on.
Yeah,
for
the
us.
Armband was a bit kryptonite, wasn't it? His game sort of fell apart the minute he's kind of strapped it on. But yeah, against Chelsea, no less, as well. It wasn't in some sort of League dead rubber. I thought that was quite heartening. There's an interesting interview I saw. I think it's on. Is it on BBC? I think it's BBC with Eric Dyer about, you know, the sort of the culture, the atmosphere at Spurs with Mourinho, which I thought was quite interesting. So, huge fan of Joe Roden.
It was really, really reassuring to think that he's... We speculate that we definitely had that faith in him, I think, already, but reassuring to see that Mourinho sees him as a viable first team, you know, starter, you know, all right, the Vieira's injured, but he's aging, and, you know, Dyer and one or two others are not, you know, maybe necessarily the greatest centre-halves in the world. So it really does reassure that he's likely to have, you know, a good number of first team opportunities at Spurs, and a Spurs team that increasingly looks like it's led by a old school Mourinho. You know, his stock has sort of crashed a little bit in recent years, but he does seem to be a little bit you know, more like what we saw him achieve at Chelsea and European clubs at the moment. You know, it's early days, I know, but it did look a little bit when he was sort of digging out whoever it was in Ndombele, you know, a year ago. And maybe this was just another step in his sort of slow decline. But I don't know, Spurs look pretty good at the moment. And if Roden and Bale can be part of that, that would be only good news for
and
us.
Ben Davis.
And Ben Davis, of course.
Guys, one of you mentioned it. It was a clean sheet against Chelsea. So, I mean, it's, Chelsea have been top form. Noticed that they've just gone top of the league this evening, till tomorrow at least, and scoring a lot of goals. So that's an impressive full debut for Spurs, for sure. And I didn't see the game, but I heard he made a couple of mistakes he got away with. Mourinho mentioned it in his post-match interview as well. But then he made the comparison between, you know, Chelsea having Thiago Silva at the back with all the experience that he's got. And he said they thought Roden did just as well, or something like that. And so he has to be pleased with him. And I agree. I mean, I've tipped Spurs to win the league this season. They could do it. Mourinho, or, you know, love him or loathe him, he's a guy who knows how to win things. You know, even when it's not going so well for him, he still picks up the odd trophy. So Spurs look a good bet to win something this season, I think.
If the international captaincy wobble comes in the last sort of half hour of a game that was already pretty much done and dusted, then that's fine, because he's starting to look to me like the sort of player who's going to go on and captain Wales a lot of times. So, you know, I think he can be forgiven the, you know, the half hour of struggling a little bit. And it sounds from the reports that Spur games like he really grew into the game after those early mistakes. So, you know, this is a player who's going to be massive for us for a long time, I think.
Yes, and Spurs have got Marine, haven't they, in the FA Cup? So it's an eighth tier, Marine from the eighth tier, Northern League in England. It's only the second time somebody for that, a team from that level, has got to the third round. So
superb.
Is it really?
I was reading it this morning. Mourinho versus Mourinho. And yeah, so we've probably just jinxed it. Roden probably start that and score an own goal in a 2-1 giant killing.
I think my cousin might have played for Marine, actually. He played with my cousin, he played with Jason Kumas at Tranmere at the youth level, I think. Or maybe Lee Trundle played for Marine. I can't remember. Perhaps I think Lee Trundle played for Marine for sure. But
I'm sad, I don't even know where they're based. It's a Liverpool Merseyside.
It's Merseyside somewhere, okay.
Well, of course, the rest of the country is going to be rooting for Marine, obviously, that day. But it's a sort of game that's probably going to get, it's probably going to be picked by TV, isn't it, by BBC?
You'd think so.
That's got to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eighth tier team against Spurs, that's going to be online.
Yeah. Okay. So let's hope Bale and Davis Roden don't play. Actually, it could be horrific. It could be horrific. Okay, let's leave it there. And the only other thing we need to do is to redo the start, because I forgot to press record.
How far do we need to get?
Just introductions. So I'll count down 3, 2, 1.
Hang on. Do you think do we need to say a sort of goodbye first?
Oh yeah, let's do a goodbye. Okay. Yeah.
so fucking professional.
So we will reconvene in a couple of days, where we will review our group, which teams we get in, as well as the Republic of Ireland in the qualifiers. So look forward to that, gents, and thank you very much for your time. Right, now we've got to do the intro. Okay, so Croeso, welcome, episode 103, usual formation. My name is Russell. Over the mountain in Caerphilly is Gareth. How are you, sir?